I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk about kindergarten this hour of the program. What I remember most about kindergarten was nap time, taking a little rug. You remember that? Some of you who are old enough to remember that was kindergarten. Well, being a kindergartner today, our guest says, is very different from being a kindergartner 20 years ago. In fact, it's more like first grade. Five-year-olds are spending more time engaged in teacher-led academic learning activities than play-based learning opportunities that facilitate child-initiated investigations and foster social development among peers. Our guest is a former kindergarten teacher, father of three girls who have recently gone through kindergarten, and he's a researcher and teacher educator in early childhood education. Christopher Brown is associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and he is with us for the first half hour of our program today. Second half hour, we'll talk about college. There's new research showing that the liberal arts are experiencing a resurgence in interest, particularly among those who are first-generation college students. So we'll talk about that hour two, a full hour of education. And we'll welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Interested in hearing your experiences about kindergarten, and particularly if you have children who are in kindergarten right now, what you're noticing, what you're experiencing. Did I give you the whole thing? 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Brown, hello. Thank you very much for being with us. Hello, Professor Brown? We'll try and get him again. The second half hour of the program, we will be speaking about college, as I said, and our guest will be an author and editor, George Anders, who says that the humanities are not just for the privileged, and we'll talk about why they're gaining in popularity. After a lot of emphasis on technical majors, he writes about some very interesting programs, and so we will be talking about that. And we already have phone calls coming in. I would think that we'll have a lot of interest in this particular topic. I was not aware that kindergarten has become like first grade, which is quite something. And there's testing being done on assessments. Teachers even are worried about the number of people who, the number of tests that they have to administer to kindergartners. And if I were in kindergarten now, I'd want to have more recess more often. Don't you need to, even when you're an adult, you need to get up and get away from your desk and do something else, and then you come back and you study for a while. But to only have 15 minutes of recess when you're 5 years old? Oh, my goodness. Okay, I think he's with us now. Professor Brown, are you there now? Professor Brown? Hello? There we go. Okay. Hi. Okay, yeah, that took a while. Hi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I didn't know anything about what was going on in kindergarten right now, and to treat it like it's being in first grade, isn't that young?
Yes and no. I think it's a challenge. Children today have changed quite a bit from children in the past. The concern is, though, that there's many things that we see as good practice in early child education disappearing from the classroom, and that is a big concern. Kids, though, I mean, there's research showing kids are reading at earlier ages. They're coming in with more academic knowledge and background because more kids have been engaged in preschool prior to entering kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
You also have families putting more effort and resources into helping educating their children at a younger age. So there's this tension there. But what's happened, at least in the work I've done and other researchers are doing, is showing that they're spending more and more time on academic content, primarily literacy instruction and mathematics, and taking away from other experiences that we think, at least those in the early child education community, think are important for kids' development and learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, you write about in your article the 15 different academic activities: decoding word drills, practicing sight words, reading to themselves, then to a buddy, counting up to 100 by fives and tens, practicing addition, counting money, completing science activities.
Yes.
And all of these, you know, fairly difficult, I would say, and writing in journals. Those are pretty heavy-duty academic pursuits. I'm sorry, it just seems very, very young to be doing all of that. You should be playing with Play-Doh and sand and water and working with each other.
I completely, I think it should be a mixture of the two. And I think that's it's trying to find that balance between the opportunity for kids to have opportunities to pursue their own learning, to pursue their own interests, and opportunities to be engaged with academic content and instruction with their teacher. Unfortunately, a lot of the research is showing that those opportunities for kids to have, you know, those times to play, those times to engage with others are diminishing or being taken away strictly to focus on the academic instruction.
Yeah. And when you talk about those good practices, what do you mean by those?
Well, giving across the day, having kids, one, have breaks, having opportunities to just decompress either through play or through recess so that they can recharge and re-engage with the learning environment. Opportunities to engage in different types of instruction outside of literacy and mathematics. You're seeing less opportunities for kids to engage in social studies-based activities where they learn about their community, they learn about themselves. And there's less opportunity for science instruction as well, which helps kids make sense of the world and come to understand the places that they live in.
I know that you did a lot of interviews with teachers and with kindergarten students. When you talk to the students, the 5-year and 6-year-olds,
yes.
What did they see as the reason for being in kindergarten?
Oh, there's a whole range of things. They know that they need to be in kindergarten to learn to do well in school. They also talk about learning to follow rules. They learned, you know, how to get along with their friends and their buddies. And they learned, you know, to help them get ready. Some talked about going to college. It's a whole range of different answers.
And the teachers seem to complain about having to do a whole lot of assessments. What are they assessing?
They assess early literacy skills, letter identification, whether kids know how what sounds letters make. They do mathematics assessments, you know, counting, simple addition at the end of kindergarten. And there's other types of different things they're looking for, depending on the schools they're working in or the districts they're in. Teachers have to be accountable to a lot of different stakeholders now, not just the kids and families in their classroom, but also the school, the district, and the state.
Mm-hmm. Most of the students said, and I can understand their thoughts about this, that they would like a little more time to play.
I think we all would.
I know. How true. That's why I'm retiring. I want more time to play.
But I think kids do want a chance to just decompress. I spent a whole semester in the classroom that I did this film with, and it's a lot of activities. And by the end of the day, everybody's exhausted. The children are, the teachers are, and I was as a researcher. And it's a lot of work and a lot of pressure on kids. And not that I'm not saying kids can't rise to the occasion, but I think it would be beneficial if they had the chance to process and to play with some of the ideas on their own away from being told what to do all the time.
Mm-hmm. So is it absolutely unheard of? Because I do remember vividly nap time when I went to kindergarten. Is there such a thing as a nap time now or not?
I don't know of nap time in kindergarten, at least in the schools and the teachers that I've talked to. Pre-kindergartens, some still have nap time. But no, nap time is pretty much gone from kindergarten.
And is this pretty widespread, what you write about, this fairly structured environment, or does it vary from state to state, district to district?
I would say it's pretty widespread, at least the people that I've talked to. I focus my research in Texas and West Virginia, and I've also talked to folks at the national level in D.C. I taught kindergarten in Virginia, and I've taught in all across the country, and teachers that I've talked to who are colleagues have talked about this as well. The article that you've been reading from has been, I've gotten a lot of responses from people all over the U.S. talking about how kindergarten is so different for their children or grandchildren, or their teachers talking about how it's changed as well. I had a nice communication with a teacher up in New York State about how it's changed so much. And one thing I think we have to realize, there are a lot of teachers with wonderful experiences in teaching kindergarten who feel like they can no longer do what they love to do, and they're actually choosing to leave the field.
Really?
Yes.
And what is it that they particularly miss?
They miss the opportunity to be, you know, engage with kids in a more playful manner, to be able to follow kids' interests, to be able to pursue a project that kids want to learn more about rather than being told what to teach and when to teach it and how long to teach it.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the answers, too, when you ask students what they were learning to follow the rules. They were learning to get to the next grade. They were learning to find a job. Really?
Yeah.
They're thinking about that at 5?
They're told that at a young age now. And that's a lot of the messages people get from about what school is all about, preparing for that next step.
Well, we have a lot of people who want to talk to you, so I'm going to go to phone calls a little early here. Let's go to Rhonda in De Pere. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and enjoy the next chapter in your life, dear.
Thank you, Rhonda.
All right. Perfect segue. Former kindergarten teacher, most of us went down to 4K. And then that just got crazy. We assessed over 569 things in 4K alone when I left.
Woo!
Now I'm a guest teacher. I'm in 18 schools, and the kitchens are becoming obsolete. I had a sand table, a paint easel every day. I played a guitar. We went for a nature walk. That stuff is history. My question is, I was hearing at the end of my career in the classroom all this talk of purposeful play, and I said to the director of 4K, I said, you need to tell me what you're talking about. She said, well, you line them up and they do the exact same thing on the playground or for playtime. And I'm like, they don't develop problem-solving skills during regular play like they would. They don't develop social skills that way. They need to just have free choice play. But the big buzzword is purposeful play, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are that they want it structured now.
It sounds like to me that they want to have more control over what kids are doing, even if they say they're trying to play. I've heard that term used in different ways by different people. In Texas, some teachers use that term, and what they mean is play within academic content areas. So there's different ways that people are using that term, but I think you raise a really good point. Play is one of those opportunities for kids to have an opportunity to play through their own ideas, their own thoughts, and be purposeful and intentional in what they want to do because they're motivated by that. I mean, kids are motivated to learn when they feel like they can do something that they're competent in, when they feel like they have the opportunity to complete the task at hand, and when they feel like they're working with others who care about them. And so when we're telling kids all to do the same thing or having them all line up and do the same exact thing, that doesn't seem like they have much choice or voice in their play, nor does it seem like it gives them the opportunity to diverge in ways that are interesting to them. So I would be concerned as well.
I wonder what happens if you don't have the experience, and it seems to me as though this should be carried beyond kindergarten, too, this sense of play and socialization and finding out what your desires and your deep interests are. If you're starting in kindergarten to have this kind of purposeful play and structured environment, don't you run the risk of young people getting sick of school by third grade?
Oh, I would, yes, very much so. And kids lose their motivation and have no desire to participate anymore. And that is a big concern. And most people who advocate for early child education, for example, the Nobel laureate James Heckman, they want people to recognize what they're focusing on is the social and emotional development in kids. That's where they develop their resilience, their desire to push forward, and to learn also how to self-regulate and motivate themselves so that they can take on new tasks and complete them.
We have some Facebook messages coming in. This one from Robin, a wonderful kindergarten teacher who I had the pleasure of working with, told the story of her children playing teacher in the classroom. The teacher's role, as they saw it, was to walk around with a clipboard assessing what students were doing. No more cozying up in the corner to, I can't read all of this, it's not coming through, but to read classmates a book.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
It just breaks your heart a little every time you read those things.
Yeah, it does, really. Thank you, Rhonda, for your call. Chris in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello. Thank you for doing this, and I hope that your retirement is fruitful, and I don't want you to retire, but let me just ask you the question. We are now saying men should have power naps at noon, and yet our young children who go a mile a minute don't let them have a nap. They need to be learning things that will make them into puppets. I never went to kindergarten. I went to a one-room rural school, but I learned all of the things in kindergarten when I was home. I visited school, but I made mud pies, cakes. I had dreams going up into the trees and dreaming and pretending and exploring and asking questions. And I ended up teaching for over 60 years, including television and children's TV and storytelling. And I have students come back and say, you let us dream when we were little. You let us explore. And we're not doing that. Kindergarten teachers today are forced to teach young children to be puppets.
Christopher.
Yeah, I would completely agree that the freedom and autonomy as a teacher is being taken away in many different ways, in terms of being surveilled by their principals and administrators, and being terms of what they're being told to teach young children. And it it's hard, I think, for teachers in the profession who want to help kids succeed in school. When they're always told what to do, they aren't sure, you know, if they can find the space within the classroom to give kids that opportunity, as you say, to dream or to figure out what they're interested in, giving them the chance to study and pursue those things.
And Christopher, where is all of this coming from, the new direction?
It's a mixture of many different things. One of the big shifts happened back in the early 2000s with the No Child Left Behind Act, focusing on ensuring all kids are performing at grade level by grade 3. So there's been a big push down, making sure every kid's on grade level in terms of the expectations at that grade level each year. So teachers feel like they have to spend more time on academic instruction to make sure every child's learning what they need to learn at by the time they leave that grade level. Common Core is also, you know, laid out expectations, and states haven't gotten rid of testing or accountability. So a lot of teachers feel that pressure to be sure that their kids are performing well on those tests.
Thanks, Chris, very much for your call. Clara in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. As a retired teacher, professor of people who want to be teachers, especially early childhood, what would you consider to be the most significant change for students and for teachers?
I think for teachers, one of the most significant changes in the past 10 years is how much required assessments they have to do with young children. Everyone I talk to is telling me how much they have to test their kids, which takes away from their instruction with their kids. I think for children, I think what they're finding is that they're constantly moving from one activity to the next without having a chance to take a break or decompress or even process what they just did before they learn the next activity.
That question is because I do keep up with what's going on in early childhood.
Yes.
For children, the most significant need that continues to show itself is their need to be able to be accommodated for their learning, for their mm-hmm. learning style at the kindergarten level. For teachers, the most significant change that I see is that the emphasis and the struggle has been placed on the backs of students for those areas that teachers seem to have little knowledge of, and that is that in the kindergarten, the compartmentalization of what you're calling academic learning has resulted in children being smart enough to determine what's in the teacher's mind when I observed a child 3 years ago looking at the teacher and saying, can we play or do we have to read?
No.
Okay. So these changes that we speak of have been put on the backs of children. Their need to learn and be accommodated has never changed. It's still there. And what makes it more complicated is they're coming to school with more tools, mm-hmm. you see, but teacher preparation has not advanced, not one iota.
Hmm. Professor Brown.
I'm not sure. That's a very good point. I think there's a tension between what teacher educators are doing with their students in their teacher preparation programs and what schools are asking teachers to do once they get in the classroom. But I think you raise a really good point that kids are the ones that carry the burden. Not only do they carry the burden with it, they're expected to want to learn. If they don't learn, they're the ones that are blamed for not learning. So it makes a really tenuous situation on young kids who are 5 or 6 years old.
Here's another Facebook message from Brandy. Playtime is where you pretend and work out problems that adults face. It gives you an opportunity to put yourself in someone else's shoes, and it also gives an opportunity to learn to work with others. Play is so important.
I completely agree.
Thank you, Clara, so much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Abby in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi there. Congrats on your upcoming retirement, Kathleen.
Thanks, Abby.
Yeah, of course. I just wanted to kind of introduce the idea of kind of how technology, especially in the past decade or so, has really inserted itself into children's lives in a way that it wasn't previously in this kind of bygone era of kindergarten we were talking about with the nap and the playtimes. And I am not a teacher, but I am a pediatric speech pathologist, so I work with kids for a living. And what I kind of see a lot is children coming in who parents are quite proud because they can navigate the iPad and they can navigate through the phone and find the playlist, but then their language skills and their just general development skills aren't quite up to where they should be. And I see sort of this correlation between parents thinking that because a child can match pictures on a screen, for instance, they can then translate that skill to real life. And it just doesn't always work that way. And also just kind of the social aspect of things, you know, children will be looking at a screen of a phone and not even realizing that we're calling their name to engage them in play. And so I'm just kind of wondering, Professor Brown, what you sort of see as not necessarily a causal relationship, like technology is causing this sort of shift away from play. But how do you see these two things kind of playing off each other, play in school versus sort of going home and not really even engaging in real play there because you're looking at an iPad screen or something like that?
Well, I think you raise a really good point. The research, empirical work on iPad is just coming out. People are just trying to understand how it does affect children's learning and development. But speaking completely anecdotally, by kids focusing on that screen, it's that one-on-one experience without having a playmate or someone else to interact with them. So they lose those opportunities, particularly from the speech communication perspective, that opportunity to engage in language with others, which is really important in their development and processing. But they also lose the social interaction where they learn how to read others' emotions and thoughts and beliefs, as well as learning how to get along and interact with others, which it really is disconcerting. It's not just, you know, kindergarten readiness is not just academic skills, and a lot of people, that's what they focus on, but I think you bring up a really good point. You can get those skills through doing some iPad activities, but you don't get the social and the emotional interaction that you also need to learn how to interact with others and, you know, self-regulate so that you can be a student in a classroom. Particularly in the schools that we work with in Texas, it's 22 kindergartners with one teacher. So learning how to interact with 22 other beings and this one adult is a really hard skill to develop. And if you don't have those opportunities prior to coming into kindergarten, it can be a really difficult transition for you as a learner.
And yet you look at what's happened in terms of technology over the last 20 years and how different kindergarten was. The use of the iPads, the use of technology is something that's omnipresent, isn't it? It's hard to imagine that we're going to shift back to a time when things were probably better for young children.
Well, I think iPads can be a useful tool in the classroom, but it should be one of many tools teachers use when they interact with kids. It, just like at home as a parent, one thing, you know, I struggle with and my wife struggle with our kids is, you know, how much time should kids have on screens? It's something we're trying to figure out and negotiate with them because we want them to have those opportunities to interact with us as well as their, you know, their sisters, which is really important in that part.
So what did you do?
We try to limit the time, how much they're on, we're trying to develop this year with our older kids. They're older now, you know, having nights where we don't even pull out our screens or iPads and just have family interaction.
Well, that sounds like a good idea.
It's a really hard idea, too.
I'll bet it is. Yeah, everybody wants to, and even the adults every now and then want to sneak off and look at those pads. Abby, thanks very much for the call. Chuck in Stone Lake. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm a retired professor of elementary education, and in my experience working in schools, I've seen a lot of kindergartners and first graders self-labeling as failures because they're not doing as well as peers on standardized measures and all the assessments with the clipboards. And it concerns me very greatly that kids are giving up. Parents are being told their kids don't measure up. And I think there's a self-fulfilling prophecy on the horizon, and it especially affects the kids from lower socioeconomic groups. So that's just my comment.
Thank you for the comment, Professor.
I think he brings up a very good point. And in many ways, these standardized assessments that we're using in school give a very fixed idea of who kids are as learners, and that's it affects them in negative ways. I think, you know, a lot of people like Peter Johnson and Carol Dweck and others are talking about how we need to think about learning as a dynamic process, that we are always growing and developing, and we shouldn't see kids learning as a fixed unit or a number. So when we put these tests in place, we just have to recognize that they're just capturing a moment, and they aren't saying who the kid is or what they know. They're just saying this is what happened at this moment, and as a teacher, we should use that to build from and help support kids in the classroom. But when we see numbers as being fixed and focusing solely on that number, it can be a very, I think, negative and possibly damaging learning environment for kids. So I would agree with that.
One more call. Larry in Rockford, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Great show. So many things that we're doing in education now is driving creativity right out of kids. Mm. Even their play is organized. They can't just go out and play basketball. They have to have a paid coach and go to camp and so forth and so on. One of the great strengths of America was our creativity. We could create things, and we're losing that. We've lost it. The kids in China sit in, you know, classrooms, recite what they've been taught and so forth, and we're copying their example, for heaven's sakes.
Professor Brown.
No, I think you raise a really good point. And actually, I've spent some time in different Chinese and Taiwanese classrooms recently, and they're trying to do more open-ended play-based learning activities with their young children. They see that what we have done in the past as being a very effective way to help raise kids who are creative and who are excited. This is just anecdotal. It's not research-based, but they're trying to provide those places for kids so that they can have a chance to be creative, to interact with others, and to pursue their own ideas and interests. So I think you raise a really good point about creativity. Mm.
I'm thinking about, I can't remember, the book was out so long ago, everything I ever needed to know I learned in kindergarten. I'll bet that's not true anymore. That was published, what, 30 or 40 years ago?
I don't know. I'd have to go. I know the book. I have to go back and read everything.
I know. I will, too, after this conversation. Thank you so much for being with us. A lot of interest in this topic. Thanks.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, and congratulations on your retirement as well.
Thank you very much. Professor Christopher Brown, Associate Professor at the University of Texas at Austin. If you have more comments, go to our Facebook page, because we did have a lot of interest in this, and it would be great to hear what you think about what's happened to kindergarten. Who I didn't know. I've been away from kindergarten for a long time, but who knew that all of these academic pursuits were taking place and assessments and testing of students? Professor Brown, Associate Professor at the University of Texas at Austin. We are going to continue. We're on an education theme this hour, and we'll be looking at liberal arts education. For many young people who are first-time college people and their families, liberal arts education has become very attractive. We'll talk about why and some special programs mentoring young people in various places around the country. All of you liberal arts graduates, listen up. We'd like to hear from you this coming half hour. This is the Ideas Network. From a recent story in The Atlantic, the unexpected value of the liberal arts. First-generation students are finding personal and professional fulfillment in the humanities and social sciences. Article written by George Anders, a business journalist, contributing editor at Forbes magazine, and author of four books, including the New York Times bestseller Perfect Enough. His newest book is You Can Do Anything, The Surprising Power of a Useless Liberal Arts Education. He spent two decades as a top feature writer for the Wall Street Journal, where he was part of a team that won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting. And thank you very much, George, for being with us. Hi.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Liberal arts graduate, were you?
I got the degree in econ, but I took no end of writing classes, linguistics classes, history classes. I was, the dilettante going through college, and somehow it's worked out okay.
Mm-hmm. So this was interesting that there are a lot of people, first-generation students, who are attracted to the liberal arts. Why? Why is that happening now?
So this is really interesting, because the stereotype is that a liberal arts degree works if you're a rich kid.
Right.
That you don't have to worry too much about what your starting pay is, because mom or dad will set you up. You don't have to worry about your network, because you've got an uncle who will take care of you. And that may or may not be true. But what really intrigued me was this sense that even for people who are the first in their family to come to college, who don't start out with that much financial or social capital, the liberal arts pathway can still work, and it's still very appealing. So there's actually data that says if you look at who's choosing to go into either the humanities or the social sciences, that's a higher enrollment number for people who are the first in their family to go to college. And it's a braver, harder path to follow, but I think it can take you to some terrific places.
And it does. You highlight some of the students who have been this route. Let's start with the story of Maylin Garcia. Her story is very interesting.
I found it tremendously compelling. So she had started out at a community college in Eastern California, close to the Mojave Desert. Her husband was in the military. He was posted overseas, and she was going, what do I do with myself? And she ended up taking a few classes in community college just to try and find some sense of purpose. She really connected with her sociology professors and with her psychology professors. They encouraged her to transfer to Berkeley once she got her two-year degree, And she's gone on to do all kinds of great things, and now she's a top digital strategist for the city of Oakland. And a lot of what she's doing is making the internet and making online work for people who don't have money, so that if you're wanting to change your jury duty date, you've now got a website and a mobile app that will let you do it. If the streets on your block are not getting fixed, you can communicate with the city online instead of having to be on hold for 20 minutes. And she describes herself as a bureaucratic ninja. Her goal is to make computer technology available to people at all levels of the income strata. And the fact that she herself has experienced all kinds of different levels of comfort and discomfort means that she's an incredibly good advocate for people who otherwise would get overlooked by our rush to bring technology.
Isn't that wonderful? She's thinking about people who probably usually have had those positions wouldn't think about because they don't have that kind of life experience.
You can end up with myopia. You only know your own group of people, and you just lose track of who else is in the mix.
You mentioned, and it's true of other people in your article, that she had support from a professor. Strong support, you write, from a faculty mentor is a powerful early propellant. Students who seek out faculty mentors nearly twice as likely to end up in leadership positions.
Yeah, this is one of my own regrets in college. Is I was, too busy hanging out with friends and doing all the other things that you do when you're 18 or 19 or 20. And there were some amazing people on the faculty, and particularly junior faculty, who are earlier in their teaching careers and eager to connect with students. And this would be my advice to anyone either going through college or with a family member going through college. You've got these incredible resources in faculty members, and the more you can get to know them and sort of strike up a friendship, the more doors they can open for you. That this is a chance to connect with an adult who's not your mom or dad, but who has your best interests at heart.
Mm-hmm. And can assess what your strengths are, and sometimes strengths that you never knew you had.
Yeah, and push you to get better, too. That they're able to see farther out on the horizon, and they've got a sense of what big openings are out there and what you need to do to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say even if you didn't have that, you've done just fine, thank you.
Don't you? I appreciate it.
Yes, you have. The other interesting thing here is the idea that we have, if you major in liberal arts, you're not going to make very much money at all. You may not find a job, and you're not going to make anything. If you go into science and math in one of those fields, jobs are there galore. But that, according to what you've written, is not necessarily the case.
So this becomes quite fascinating. And in fact, I have several tables in the book, You Can Do Anything, that show what your first-year earnings are likely to be and then what your mid-career ones are. And for a lot of liberal arts fields, particularly history, international relations, even philosophy, there's a really sudden ramp-up. So, yes, your first job is not too amazing, but 10 years out, you're working in some pretty exciting situations. And I compare the earnings curves for those fields versus some of the very safe, steady majors like nursing or accounting. And year one, yes, you're going to make more with an accounting degree. But by year 10 or year 15, it's that liberal arts degree that's actually earning more for you.
Oh, that's fascinating. You also highlight some programs. And usually when we think of college, we think of the large lectures. You sit there for an hour, you take notes, and maybe you'll have a discussion group that also has a large number of people in it. You highlight some programs, career readiness programs, that seem to be very helpful for students, particularly first in the family, to go to college. Discuss those, please.
So the key idea here is to create a cohort of people who look like you, who've grown up in the community you've grown up, who you go, I can connect with them. And there's one particular program called Braven. It's got installations in New Jersey at Rutgers and in California at San Jose State. It's coming to the Midwest. They're setting up an initiative in the Chicago area with more expansion. And the whole idea is to have five or six students meet with a mentor who's only a few years older than them, and to meet once a week in the evening and just talk about, how do I do an interview? How do I get my resume together? How should I be using LinkedIn? If I had an interview that goes well, what's my follow-up? Who do I write a note to? If I had an interview that went badly, how do I regroup so that the next time I go through a job interview, I can handle that hard question? And it's both very good on the tactical side, but it's also good in building up a sense that we can do this. We can do this together. So I chronicle the adventures of one student, Dylan Brown Bramble, And in his program, he had said they developed an ethos that if one of us succeeds, all of us succeed. And suddenly you aren't alone at college. You aren't feeling there's no one here like me. There's no one who understands me. You get to a much better place and you go, I've got a group of people who are cheering for me and I'm ready to go and take that next challenge. Mm-hmm. So just building up esteem, building up social and tactical skills, tremendously valuable, and it's best done on a small level like this.
But the programs are few and far between now. Do you see the possibility that they'll really expand?
There's lots of room for them to increase. And in fact, one of the really interesting things about the Braven program is that local employers love it. And they love it for two reasons. One is they can hire the students that come out of these programs, and that helps them get a stronger workforce. But the other thing is it's a great retention tool for their promising people in their mid-20s, late-20s. And the answer is you can work at our big company, and we'll underwrite you going and mentoring in the evening for these kinds of students. And all of a sudden, working at Prudential Insurance Company or working at those kinds of big corporations right. becomes a lot more appealing. So as long as you can get big companies underwriting this, there's only so much money in education, but there's lots of money in the corporate sector.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the growth, is that as you get enlightened companies or even self-interested companies, they can say, you know what, this is a great way to get the workforce we want and to keep people.
So for all of those philosophy majors, those sociology majors, those history majors, where can they what should they think about where they could be in terms of their careers that maybe it never struck them before? You mentioned some of those.
So let me go through some of the new emerging areas. So a lot of anthropology majors are now ending up as user experience specialists for companies that have websites facing the world. So in fact, I opened the book with a story of an anthro major who is now working at Etsy, the arts marketplace.
Oh.
And they need someone to go out and do field research. So, you know, it's not going into the traditional rural Mexican village, but it's not that different. You go and you talk to artists of what kind of art do you make, who do you want to connect with, why did you end up in art? And pretty soon you've got a real understanding of who your user base is and how to make the site work better for them. So, you know, the dress code's a little different and, you know, the food's a little different. But you're using anthropology skills front and center. I also tell a lot of stories in You Can Do Anything about English majors who have discovered that in the age of social media, the ability to tell a story and to make it funny and unexpected and ironic is incredibly valuable. And you may not write the great American novel, but you can write the great American infographic, and you can get paid well for it, too. So that is a big, rich area that's opening up, and there's a lot more you can do with an English degree than people might have realized 10 years ago.
Well, let's talk to some of those of you who are in the audience who are in college now, and you're getting a liberal arts education. Maybe you're doing history or philosophy or anthropology, or you did this and you've been able to find your way in the world, and you can prove that a liberal arts degree is not useless, that you can surge in terms of earning, in terms of satisfaction, in terms of finding really interesting jobs as a result of what it is that you majored in that wasn't something that we think you need to major in to be successful these days. Here's our phone number, our 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. He's a business journalist. A portion of the book that he has written is in The Atlantic, which caught our attention. He is the author of You Can Do Anything, The Surprising Power of a Useless Liberal Arts Education. He's a business journalist, contributing editor at Forbes magazine, and author of a number of books. So we'll be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Okay, let's go back to phone calls. Caroline in Appleton. Hi.
Hello there. First of all, congratulations on your retirement.
Thank you.
And I feel like I'll be losing a friend at 1 to 3 in the afternoon.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I am an English major. When I graduated from college, my father said, what are you going to do? And I'll tell you what I have done. I've been a radio announcer, a television newscaster, a television producer. I have been a director of marketing for a tech company. And today I'm the owner of a quite successful market research firm.
All right.
So all I can say is what got me through all of that was I could write.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen in my business experience through all of these years that people who can write can do almost anything.
Well, congratulations on your career. It's terrific.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. That's the other part. It gave me all that ability to be able to, like, just kind of morph into something different.
Right, and to do something that you thoroughly enjoy doing, which
I love it. Just love it.
Good thing. George.
That is a really great point, and I would add a second skill that is probably so second nature to you that you don't even realize how unusual it is. You're able to learn new fields quickly and get up to speed fast. And that is something that makes people employable through their whole lives. And
but that's partly because of a really broad background in a lot of different liberal arts areas, because you are like, bang, I can do this, bang, I can do that. I can see all these things because I can know about 18th century literature. I know about French literature. I know about architecture. I know about philosophy. And all those things are not exactly related, but everything is sort of related.
That's beautiful, and that sense of you build up the muscles to get smart on a new field, and if you're doing that at 19 or 20, you can do it at 35 or 55. Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. And so I always say, go liberal arts majors.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Caroline. Great. And it's also a good way to live, to say nothing of a job. It's nice to know a lot about various areas because the world is a phenomenally interesting place, isn't it?
So, in fact, there's Gallup data on how people feel about their jobs, and they ask them, they're then sorted once they ask them, do you like your job or not? Does it matter if you went to a high-end school or a low-end school? Does it matter if you're male or female? The one thing they found that made a difference was the liberal arts graduates were about 2 percentage points happier than the science and engineering.
Really?
Yeah. And it's not a giant difference, but it's not trivial either. There's that chance to work with people and to advocate a cause that can be very fulfilling.
Well, maybe we're suffering from a lack of imagination here, too, that liberal arts majors need to know what's out there in the world for them because we don't want to be defeated.
So, in fact, one of the stories that goaded me to bring this book to the finish line, I was talking with the head of career services at Reed College, which is the ultimate liberal arts college. Whatever you think should be done in liberal arts, they do 10 times as much of it. And she had done a presentation to a whole lot of parents of students and described all the different things you could do. And at the end, one of the parents said, well, this all sounds very nice, but is there any way you can get rid of all that meandering in the middle? And the answer is no, the meandering's the whole point of it. So I wrote this book, you know, to some extent to give meandering its good name back again.
I'm glad you did. Let's go to Casper in Marshfield. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm one of those anthropology majors. I majored in anthropology and philosophy with a minor in religious studies.
All right.
And so I was just about as liberal as it gets in terms of the well-roundedness. And I ended up following through and did a doctoral degree in anthropology. And I ended up in the medical world, which I tremendously enjoy. And I adapted very quickly, which I think is a trait of the liberal arts student. My comment and question is more along the lines of, like, when I give advice to folks who have a niece or a nephew that they're getting an anthropology degree and their parents or aunts and uncles are worried about them, they say, what kind of advice would you give? And I said, well, you know, combining the liberal arts education with technical skill sets like nursing or engineering is really a strength. I agree with the approach to celebrating liberal arts education, but I think the technical skills that can complement it, that to me seems to be the secret recipe for a really gifted, strong, engaged worker.
So how would you go about doing that in terms of school? Can you do all of that in college, do you think, Casper?
The advice I've always given is that an anthropology minor and a nursing bachelor's degree in the healthcare world would be fantastic, and those that are pre-med with their eyes on the white coat. I've given them the same advice, doing a four-school anthropology approach as their bachelor's degrees, and as they move up through their graduate training, that's where they specialize with those technical skills.
Oh, that's interesting. George.
So just to build out that notion of pairing a liberal arts orientation with some technical training, there are a lot of opportunities now that tie into fields like design, that tie into fields like data analytics, where if you have a little bit of statistics or a tiny bit of computer programming, you don't need a lot. In fact, I have a chapter where I talk about all the people now who are telling stories with numbers, because as we produce all of this data, how are you going to absorb it? How are you even going to figure out what it means? And surprise, surprise, this is a pretty good home for English majors that have taken one or two stats classes, because the software does all the numbers now. You need to understand what it means and what a standard deviation is, but that's not going to take you too long. Pick up a couple classes of that and then become the person who can present the data, and that becomes really valuable. The other option, of course, is to pick up some technical training on the side, and there are programs like General Assembly that will give you a 6-week or a 9-week program. So if you didn't do it on campus, you can gain the skills you need to step into some of these areas that straddle the world of liberal arts and the technical world.
Thanks, Casper, so much for your call and encouragement. Kelsey in Lancaster, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. I myself have a liberal arts education, and my degree is in classical Greek, which was a very large concern of my parents.
Yeah, I imagine.
But I guess I don't directly use the classical Greek portion of my degree. I'm now working in a successful insurance company. But I will say that the liberal arts education provided me a really well-rounded education, as well as some really in-depth studies in communications. And I just wanted to echo the sentiment of the earlier caller who was describing how writing has led her to be successful. And I think it's the communication emphasis in general that I found to be really helpful.
I'm sure it does. And why classical Greek, Kelsey?
You know, I actually started out as an English major with a classical Greek minor, but I loved it, and I just kept taking more classes to the point where one of my professors said, you know what, you're only a class away from a major in Greek if you want to finish that out. So I did.
And when people see that you majored in that at this point, what did they say to you?
Why did you?
Why, just what I asked you. Why classical Greek?
Yeah.
Well, this communications, knowing how to write, knowing how to talk, is coming through pretty loudly and clearly, George.
And, in fact, let me add a parallel piece that the classics are really good at. Because the amount of material available to any classics student is limited, you get to be very good at detailed analysis of the text and trying to figure out every detail you possibly can find in it. And you know who absolutely loves that is Wall Street. Because when you're analyzing financial statements, they're tiny little clues, and most people, you read it fast, you don't even see it. So I've been surprised to see how many classics and philosophy majors end up doing very well in the investment world.
Really?
Yes. Not one of these things I would have expected.
No.
The foundational skill is pretty similar, and if you can make sense of Thucydides, you can probably make sense of a company's 10-K.
It would strike me, though, as very different areas of interest, that if you were interested in Thucydides, would you then necessarily be interested in the Dow Jones?
You know, one of the things I loved in this book about talking to people in their, late teens, early 20s, is our minds are so pliable at that stage, and people could take themselves in a lot of different directions. And, yeah, by the time you get to be 35 or 40, you've locked down, and that's your field of interest. But you can come up with almost any pairing possible, and somewhere there's someone who finds both those worlds interesting.
And what are the numbers, George? What percentage of college graduates are in liberal arts these days, and is that number going up?
So if you define it broadly, of all of the humanities and all of the social sciences, it's probably about 28-30%. And what's happened the last 10 or 15 years, business majors have really gone up in a big way. That's now become the most common major. And if you go back 20 or 40 years, it would have been either education or English. And the English major sort of took a dive in the 70s and early 80s, and it's kind of stabilized since. But if you go back half a century, a lot of people went to college and studied English, and that's much less common now. But I'm encouraging people to still look at this as a pathway that can lead to not just a great career, but also a great life.
Right. And then there's something to be said for continuing your education as well.
You have to, yeah. And the world keeps changing, and the opportunities to learn are just exciting in their own right.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, thanks so much for the call. Well, George, thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Oh, it was a delight.
George Anders, he has a book that it has just been published, You Can Do Anything, The Surprising Power of a Useless Liberal Arts Education. He's a business journalist and contributing editor at Forbes magazine, and is the author of a number of books, including the bestseller Perfect Enough. This piece that he wrote in The Atlantic caught our attention, The Unexpected Value of the Liberal Arts. Thanks very much to Gretchen Brown for producing this hour and to Colleen Leahy for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, of course, and for listening. As always, we'll be with you again tomorrow talking about Russia Hour 2 and talking about the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times competing for the latest scoop on the Trump administration Hour 2.